what?
We finally got the 2024 Messy Reformation Conference on the schedule. Block off your calendars for April 15th through the 17th, 2024. The theme for our first ever conference is courageous leadership, with a particular emphasis on what courageous leadership looks like in times of reformation. In our current reformation, the CRC needs leaders who are willing to stand firm in their convictions and lead their churches, classes, and denomination with courage and boldness. We've designed this conference to help equip, encourage, and paint a vision for what that courageous leadership will look like wherever God leads us. To find out more about this conference, or to get signed up right away, head on over to themessyreformation.com. Don't wait to get signed up. We need people to get signed up as soon as possible to get a handle on how many people are coming and what to expect, so don't wait. And don't miss this opportunity to equip yourself, connect with fellow leaders, and be part of this messy reformation in the CRCNA. As you know, whenever reformation has happened in the history of the church, things get messy and courageous leaders are needed. That's why we're taking the opportunity to have conversations with pastors throughout the Christian Reformed Church to find out what's going on in our denomination, but also to talk about what reformation might look like. If you haven't already, take a moment to click subscribe so you don't miss any of our upcoming content. We're dropping episodes every single Sunday evening. It's also important for you to know that you are our marketing plan. We rely on you to spread the word about what we're doing at the Messy Reformation. We rely on you to share our content. We also rely on you to give us 5-star reviews and provide good feedback for this podcast so that the algorithms push our content further into the world that needs to hear what we're saying. You are the marketing plan, and we believe we've placed our marketing in good hands. You can also support us financially on Patreon or Substack. All the money raised is used to fund online hosting and build the platform of the Messy Reformation. With all that said, we're going to get to this week's episode, which is part 2 of our conversation with Tim Blackman.
I thought that was a shame because to me, from a church order perspective, Synod is there to do the work of the church. And that work is spiritual. It does not need to be made spiritual or to have conferred upon it a sense of spirituality through prayer and more worship. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, haters are going to say, oh, he's saying we pray too much, we worship. No, the work itself is spiritual.
Yeah.
And we needed to do that work and we didn't have the time for it. And now, again, in the end, Lord willing, 2024, there will be time to have those discussions carefully, deliberately, patiently. But that was a massive frustration. I don't know if you even asked what my frustration was, but that just came out many months after the fact.
No, that's good. Well, you and I had a very brief conversation right after it all happened. I was still in shock about what was going on. Yeah. I stood next to you and you're like, well, I guess we're done.
Right.
You know,
right?
Like, what just happened here? Yeah.
Right.
But my encouragement has been, as I, you know, now having been the chair of that committee, I've been involved in a lot of conversations moving forward and people talking about how do we move forward coming into 2024. And I still think, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but from what I can tell from the conversations, the work that we did is laying a strong foundation for what's going to happen at 2024. And so I think still, even though it didn't get done in 2023, the hard conversations we had, the wrestling we had with things is going to carry through. And I think the majority, there's going to be tweaking, obviously, with some of the recommendations coming out of our committee. But I think as a whole, what was going to pass, what we felt like was going to pass in 2023 will probably pass in 2024.
Right. Well, and I think it fits with the theme of your, you know, of your channel here. It's messy. It was difficult. I think everyone in our committee, obviously myself included, knows we are susceptible to human error. We offered our recommendations tentatively, provisionally, prayerfully, knowing that they would still need to be open for either ratification or further iteration. I mean, no one on Advisory 8 would argue for the inerrancy and the infallibility of our recommendations. And we even know that, you know, several of those recommendations that we did make were already denied, some were deferred. But I think what I loved about it is that we did to the best of our ability, the patient, painstaking, and sometimes clumsy synodical procedures to the best of our abilities, with an understanding of what the church order and the confessions mean for us. I think that's what we try to do. And I'm looking forward to see how, you know, Synod 2024 will develop that and improve on what we did, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they probably will improve on it and in positive ways.
Yeah.
I know. So. Yeah. I think, I lost my train of thought there. I had a really, really great insight and lost it. So we did good work, and I'm thinking that, I've heard a lot of conversation leading up to 2024 on kind of what needs to happen coming forward. And I know there probably will be some, one of the things I wanted to kind of warn people about maybe leading into 2024 is the worry of, I think there might be a little bit of a stall tactic coming as far as like, well, this gravamen conversation is really, it's really big and complicated and it's hard to understand. And so we probably need to kick this to a study committee to have people spend more time figuring it out. And my response is, that's ridiculous for one, I think. We can't kick this down the road anymore. But one of the things that has really muddied the water, and this is what I was going to say, I finally remembered, was that there's a different, people are mistaking the conversation around what does our church order actually say?
Yeah.
And how are we functioning, or how have we functioned over the years? And I keep trying to tell people, it doesn't matter if we functioned poorly over the years. What our job as synod right now is to say, here's what our church order says. Here's how we're supposed to be functioning.
Right.
Now, if we want to change that, you need to have overtures coming to change the church order to change how we function. But just because we've been functioning improperly for the last 50 years or whatever, doesn't mean we interpret the church order differently moving forward.
Right. Yeah. And I think for me, and this is something that we've even talked about at our own classes here in Classes Muskegon, is that if you take a step back from the current controversies, the gravamen process, the controversies around whether or not ministers can be held accountable for having views that are contrary to the confessions and to the scriptures, for me, the even bigger issue, and this is, I think, connected to our wider culture, and is how clumsy we are, and how uncomfortable we are with our own identity as confessional Reformed Christians, having those confessions expressed in a church order. And maybe more specifically, when you think of our identity, our confessional standards have identified three marks of the true church: the faithful preaching of the word, the faithful administration of the sacraments, faithful exercise of discipline. John Calvin used to call those three marks the sinew of the church. We can assume that there's widespread denominational agreement on the importance of the preaching of the word. I also don't think we'd have to count the votes about the significance of the proper administration of the sacraments. We seem to be convinced of the intrinsic merit and value of those two marks. But when we talk about the third one, we get nervous. When we talk about church discipline, we start telling stories, and they abound, there's many of them, about how clumsy we've been when practicing church discipline. It seems like we are rarely ever at our best when engaging in church discipline. Somehow it brings out the worst in us, and it has all these negative connotations. It sounds regressive and hypocritical, and you hear people bandy around words like it's toxic and it's punitive. And I think the bigger issue is for us to learn to have the audacity to use the language of correcting faults and punishing sins, like Belgic Confession 29 talks about. We don't talk that way anymore. We're uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting, just as you were talking about that, one of the things we've said repeatedly on the podcast is, on the one hand, the CRC hasn't been afraid to do discipline when it comes to moral and life issues. Yeah. Right. So if a pastor is abusing his wife, they will discipline him. Boom. Yeah. I mean, it's not, no question asked, right? There's but when it comes to doctrinal issues, we're like, well, I don't know. We're not sure. There's some gray areas in here and we've been kind of hesitant on that. But also connected to that, where you had mentioned that, you know, stories abound on how we've failed at discipline. But we don't hear very many stories of when discipline has gone well and has been effective.
Yeah. Yeah.
And part of that's just the nature of it, right? What church is going to go around publicly saying, hey, we disciplined this person and they repented and they came back into the church. It's just not what's going to happen. But when somebody gets angry about something, everybody knows that they're going to tell everyone, and everyone hears about the bad stuff, but we don't really hear about the positive ways in which church discipline has functioned for the good of a person or for the church.
Well, and this is exactly this. Your last sentence is exactly what I'm after, for the good of the church. You know, the Belgic Confession, and I think we should all go back and read Article 29. In fact, I have it open here, where it talks about the well-being of the church, the sign of the true church of Jesus Christ. I found it. The true church can be recognized when it practices church discipline for correcting faults. In short, it governs itself according to the pure word of God, rejecting all things contrary to it and holding Jesus Christ as the only head. By these marks, one can be assured of recognizing the true church, and no one ought to be separated from it. We don't want anyone separated from it. We don't want anyone to go against it. This has to do with the flourishing of our congregations. And so somehow it's got, obviously, discipline, because we're clumsy and experienced at it on theological matters, doesn't go well or is not done. But I think at least recovering the importance of it should be an important conviction for the next few synods, it seems to me. This is good and important work, and it's important work for the future of the church.
Yeah,
this is not just a bunch of mean fundies, you know, laying down the law. This is the work of the Spirit, gathering, protecting, preserving a body of believers.
Amen. And it's kind of funny if you look at the other two marks of the church. There's plenty of stories abounding of really, really poor, terrible preaching. And you don't see anybody saying, well, we should maybe just do away with preaching because there's a lot of really bad preachers out there. Right. Instead, it's more along the lines of, we really need to train people and to preach well and to do their job well and administer the sacraments. And really that's probably the emphasis should be right now is we need to start training churches and pastors on how to administer discipline so that we can do it well. Instead of saying, well, we do it poorly, so we should stop doing it. Right. The conversation really should be, we've done it poorly. Let's start doing it. Let's figure it out. We can save our old church discipline stories like our sermons so that we can weep over them.
Right.
But continue to work on learning how to do it well in ways that bring glory and honor to God. And as you said, ways that protect the church.
Yeah, this might be the time to revive G.K. Chesterton's axiom, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly.
That's right.
It's worth doing. It's valuable. And we don't get it right all the time. And obviously, regrettably, people get hurt and churches flounder in the process. But it's still worth doing and recovering as something that we've covenanted together. I hope that we together as a denomination, which I've grown to love very much, you know, learns how to do that in a loving and beautiful and life-giving and gracious and truthful way. I mean, that's what I hope will happen the next few years.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, I would be curious what your thoughts are on this, but just as I've been having conversations about what's coming up at 2024, it seems like kind of the two main issues coming up to 2024 is one is the finishing of the work from our committee around Gravamen. We have to come up with some kind of clarity on that, and we got to land in a good place there. Yeah. But then some form of discipline/disaffiliation it seems inevitable, even though Better Together still you know, just got this massive grant now. They're still calling for unity, but it seems just inevitable that we cannot continue to walk hand in hand together. Is that kind of what you're seeing too, as the main things happening leading up to 2024?
You know, I don't know if I've given the future of the next synod or the next two enough thought to adequately comment on that. I have been struck, and maybe this might help us chart a way forward a little bit. I've been struck more by what has happened in the last, let's say, 7 years, when we introduce concepts and approaches that are outside the church order into the synodical discussion. And I'm thinking of two in particular, the confusion — this is a much longer conversation — the confusion around what exactly is the nature of pastoral advice. What do we mean with that term? Because if you go back all the way to the early 70s, it meant originally that pastoral advice was the logical entailments and the practical implementations of everything that a synod had taught.
Yeah.
Later on, that term began to move a little bit more as to mean that it's a slightly lesser degree — this was, I think, after 75, a lesser degree of compliance required. I think that clarification still needs to be made.
Yeah.
And that was even less confusing than the 2016 overture from Classis Arizona. They introduced this concept of status confessionis.
Mm.
That term is not found in our church order. It was originally found in the adiaphoristic discussions of the Lutheran church, just in the post-Reformation, about things like, what should clergy wear? Should they wear habits? Should they marry? Should, you know? And then status confessionis meant there is an emergency situation about which the church needs to make a statement. That's what it originally meant. The next time really that comes up is in the 80s, when the Reformed Church in South Africa says, we need to make an emergency statement about apartheid and racism because we feel that the gospel needs to be addressed to this particular social issue. That's what that meant. And so I think, as far as we can tell, when in 2016 Classis Arizona decides to use that phrase, they use that in a historically correct way,
as
an emergency pronouncement on a matter of great importance to the church. Then, of course, we see that now that term has morphed, and people mean very different things with that term. I think a lot of the confusion that happened because we could not clearly define, trace back the provenance of those two terms, pastoral advice, status confessionis. And frankly, you're going to have that coming forward now. Now you hear terms like, we are a church in protest. I don't know what that means. I don't know. It's possible that I don't know the church order well enough. But now we are going to introduce another category that does not belong in our church order. I could be wrong. Somebody will correct me in the comments, I'm sure. But I think we need to stick with our playbook, or change it, as you said. But I think confusion will happen if we start bringing in extracurricular categories to try to navigate our way forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And the difficulty with all of that, I remember it was probably 3 or 4 years ago when all of the terminology, especially around pastoral advice, came out. I was like, what are they talking about? And so I was going to I'm going to write something to try to clear this up, but it gets so convoluted trying to go back and show here's what the word meant back then. Yeah. Clearly. And now it kind of morphed. I'm not actually convinced that, you know, Synod 1975 is the one where they go back to and they say that they lowered the importance of pastoral advice. But even if you read that, it doesn't say that it's less important. It just says pastoral advice should be understood as pastoral advice. And it's like, well, what does that mean?
Right.
That doesn't mean anything.
Pastoral advice will always be an idea, a perspective, a conviction that is the logical entailment, the necessary theological complement to the pastoral practice of what has just been taught. It can obviously never mean that it would mean that the application of the pastoral advice would be the opposite of the theological opinion that's just been expounded. That would be ludicrous.
Yeah, it's impossible, right? And so that's why it has been such a weird way to try to say, well, we can just kind of hold whatever we want around this. Cause yeah, if you're teaching doctrinally something very different than what the pastoral advice is based on, then I don't know. I still haven't been able to figure out how they.
Here's what I think it should be. I mean, maybe we need a definition. I would say something like we need pastoral advice is providing practical guidelines that are concomitant with the report's findings at a local level in a language that people can understand and that are actionable for churches.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. That would be helpful if we could get there and understand that. We've got a ways to go yet to even get to that point, right? That's really one of the reasons why, just as I met with a group of pastors a few weeks ago and we were talking about Synod 2024, and you know, they always ask me because they know I'm kind of in the midst of this is something, it's like my hobby, I guess, which is kind of sad. But anyways, but they're guys that are not really involved with this, but they're just tired of it. They're like, man, we have bigger conversations to be having as a church than whether we should embrace this or not. Like we need to wrap this conversation up and start having more helpful conversations about how to live this out in our churches, right? Even one of my close friends, we had a lot of conversation leading up to last year's synod, and he's a male who struggles with same-sex attraction. He's committed to celibacy, and he's like, the CRC needs to have a better conversation about how we care for people in that situation. And I'm like, amen. Yeah. But we can't have a good conversation about that right now because we have some people saying, well, just embrace them in there living that practice out, and other people. And so how do you give pastoral advice in that situation if we don't have clarity on even the theological foundations and outworking of that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, you put your finger on something important. I think there is a sense of fatigue. There's a sense of tiredness. And I realize that for any number of reasons, I don't have that yet. I feel new to the conversation. This was my first synod. I don't struggle with same-sex attraction. So I realize existentially, this is a very different conversation for me than for other people for whom this is a matter of tremendous existential import. For me, it is a matter of gospel importance, obviously. There's a lot at stake. But I still feel like I have energy for the conversation. I still think it matters. And just like we decided that there's all kinds of other things at Synod that really matter. We need to, as a denomination, we need to figure out, how do we actually do evangelism? How do we disciple people? I don't think we know how to do that as a denomination. How do we train office bearers, elders, and deacons? I don't think we really know, have shown that we really know how to do that. So to me, those are all important, and I still have some energy. But I appreciate for people who are just tired and beat up and on both sides of our divide who feel exhausted. I get that.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's been a few of the people that I was talking with were at the 2016 synod, right? And that was exhausting. So they kind of feel like they've been in this for 7, 8 years now. And they're like, man, we've been wrestling with this for so long and we've just kind of come to a point. And that's really the sense, you know, I remember as a committee, this will connect, but as I was chairing our advisory committee, I came into it assuming that we were going to have a lot of like division there, right? And all of a sudden I'm like, wow, we have a lot of clarity, a lot of unity on a lot of things. But then there came a point, right? Where I remember stopping the conversation and saying, hey guys, all right, we're not getting anywhere. We're obviously going to have a majority minority report here. Like this is just, we found a lot of unity in a lot of places, but we can just tell the conversation's not moving forward anymore. And so it's time to kind of go our separate ways. And that's what it feels like in the denomination right now, right? Like we're just, we're not making any progress here. We're just, there's a clear division happening. And I think it's what's best for the denomination and for the church in general, right? For us to just find a clean way to just acknowledge that separation and then move our separate ways and go forward.
Yeah. You know, I think those were, that captures the tension I felt in our committee for, it seems like 90% of the time, there was tremendous unity around really important things from nearly everybody in our group. There were things that we were able to present to Synod, I think, where that were unified. They were shared convictions. And then there was the other part where I felt in some of the conversations that we had such, not only different theologies, not only different nuances when it comes to understanding what the word chastity means or whether or not homosexual sex or relationships are against the scriptures. But if you take a step back from it, it felt like there was a different hermeneutic, a different exegesis, different convictions. At times, frankly, it felt like there were different religions. There were different fundamental theological convictions. Some people would say that of me, and I would say that of other people. And I think living with those kind of fundamental divisions, I think is very challenging going forward. In Dutch, there is a saying. It's een geloof met, of een bed met twee kussens, daar slaapt de duivel tussen. And it essentially means a marriage bed with two different faiths has the devil sleeping in between.
Mm.
And all that to say is, and this is usually in the Netherlands in the context of a Protestant marrying a Roman Catholic. I think that's where that saying originally comes from. But it's to say that at some point you're going to run into deeply held convictions that are at variance with each other. And you need to realize that being married is hard enough as it is. Being in a denomination, doing life together in a covenantal union is hard enough already as it is. If then you throw in a deep divide on exegesis and hermeneutics, it's nearly schizophrenic. It's hard. I don't know if it's tenable. Yeah. I don't know if it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I 100% agree. Yeah. Well, Tim, we're coming right down to the end of our episode.
I thought we've been talking for like 2 minutes.
I know. It's great. We could talk for a few more hours probably. Yeah. But one of the things we like to do is just give all of our guests an opportunity to kind of give some final thoughts. We have a pretty, you know, when I first started this podcast, I thought, well, we're just shooting for like conservative pastors in the CRC. They're the ones who are probably involved in some of this, but we have a really broad range of people listening to this, broader than a lot of elders and deacons and lay members. And we've got some college students and some high school students listening. So we got a big, broad range of people kind of tuning in, wanting to figure out what's going on. And so what would be some kind of final words of wisdom or thoughts that you'd want to leave them with at the end of this episode?
Well, I think maybe out of my own experience now, you know, I've been at Second CRC in Grand Haven for the last year and a half. And this congregation has made me fall in love with the Christian Reformed Church all over again. Obviously, the first time leading an established Christian Reformed Church. And this is a church that had where there's people from a wide variety of backgrounds and theological and political opinions. And one of the things that I have loved to see is I've done a Wednesday night class now for, I did a fall session on the Heidelberg Catechism, and I just concluded the winter session on the Canons of Dort. And so it has been exhilarating for me to sit with brothers and sisters rereading the sources. We have gone back to the sources. And here's what I have found. The class is made up of believers ages 15 to 93. Various levels of intellectual capability, and some people are brand new to the denomination. I've got some recovering Baptists and Lutherans and Catholics. And then there's people that have been in this church for the last 90 years. Hmm. And by and large, what has been wonderful to see is the old CRC folks say, we've never really read it. We memorized it in catechism. We were forced to do it, learn it by rote. We haven't read it since. It's not made a significant impact on our lives ever since then. And now to come at it and you find out the things that you can read about the beauty of the miracle of regeneration in the canons of Dort, for example, that it's akin to the miracle of creation, and it will not be outdone by the miracle of the resurrection. To reread those again, afresh, without the urgencies of the conflict pressing in on us right now, has been exhilarating for me. And that's what I hope we go back to as congregations, that we say we have a treasure trove that we're sitting on. Let's read what they actually say. Let's use them in our prayers for evangelism. Let's use them as convictions that will fuel our preaching and our pastoral care and our ministry, because I think they are saturated with God glorifying and consoling troubled souls. That's what it's there for. So I hope that your listeners go back to, you know, reading Canons of Dort, Belgian Confession, Heidelberg Catechism, and reading the scriptures in light of them. And yeah, that's what I'm here for.
That's all we have for this week. If you want to help us out and support the Messy Reformation, another thing you can do is sign up for our newsletter through Substack. That way you'll get episodes and summaries sent directly to your email inbox. It will also give us the opportunity to communicate with our audience, which is one of the biggest struggles of a podcast. So head over to the Messy Reformation on Substack and sign up for our newsletter. Now, stay tuned next week for our conversation with Jared Luchibor. But until then, don't forget this is Christ's church, and he bought it with his blood. And we've been warned that wolves will come in trying to destroy the flock. So keep a close watch on your life and on your doctrine. Preach the word in season and out of season, and keep fighting the good fight in this messy Reformation.